I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store, in for Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On June 21st, the Supreme Court ruled that a Maine state program that provides private school tuition payments for students in towns that don't have public schools cannot exclude religious schools, enabling taxpayer dollars to be spent on religious education. Less than a week later, the court ruled in favor of a Washington high school football coach who would kneel and lead prayers on the field before and after games. Two decisions that, some say, shrink the separation of church and state and recalibrate the balance between Americans' right to religious freedom and freedom from government-imposed religion. And that's what we're going to be talking about this hour. Joining me is Linda Greenhouse. She covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for three decades until 2008 and is now journalist in residence and lecturer in law at Yale Law School. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, Kimberly. Good to talk with you again.
And we are also joined by Michael McConnell. He is a professor at Stanford Law School and director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. Hello, Michael.
Hi.
I should say you're also the author of the upcoming book, Agreeing to Disagree, How the Establishment Clause Protects Religious Diversity and Freedom of Conscience. So, Linda, I want to turn to you first. You know, back in law school, I learned that sometimes different protections, constitutional protections, such as the right to free exercise and the protection against government-imposed religion, can sometimes bump up against each other. And what the court has to do is find the play in the joints, find a way to compromise to protect both. Do you see that after these two cases? Do you see the court still doing that?
Well, I know Michael and I are going to disagree on a lot of issues that we're going to discuss, but as I read the praying coach decision, Kennedy, the decision that actually used that phrase, play in the joints, it was, I believe, the late Chief Justice Rehnquist's last major opinion for the court before his death. That has been, if not formally overruled, dispensed with. And we now have free exercise all the way. And as I see it, I know Michael will disagree, I see the Establishment Clause being whittled down to a bare nub.
And Michael, I want to turn to you. Do you disagree with what Linda just said?
Well, for the most part, I do. The First Amendment is not at war with itself. We have rights of freedom of speech. We have rights of free exercise of religion. We have rights against establishment of religion. All of these freedoms were supported by the same people for the same reasons. They were never thought to be at odds with each other. The idea that they are at odds with each other is the product of the last several decades. It's a relatively new phenomenon in American history. And when you look at each of these cases, the real question is whether the religious activity is a product of individual choice or whether it's an imposition of government. And when, Coach Kennedy, at the end of a game, after his players had gone, went by himself, knelt at the 50-yard line and said a brief prayer, he was not the government. To say that something like that is an establishment of religion is to misunderstand what establishment is.
So Chief Justice John Roberts, in the majority opinion of the main case that I mentioned, the one about the tuition reimbursement program that allowed parents to use state taxpayer money for private school, but excluded religious schools on the argument that that would violate the Establishment Clause. Justice Roberts said not only would it not violate the Establishment Clause, he called the program, quote, discrimination against religion. Linda, isn't the First Amendment supposed to protect against discrimination against religion? And where do you think the Chief Justice got it wrong?
Well, so this notion of discrimination has really come up in the last several years, actually, the notion that unless an individual or a governmental program or whatever is allowed to privilege religious exercise to the max, there was some kind of discrimination. What we saw coming out of a term ago in the Supreme Court, the most favored nation idea about religion, that if there's any comparable program, exercise, that it treats something else better than religion, then that violates the free exercise clause, and that's discriminatory. And of course, the notion of comparable is in the eye of the beholder, and the beholder is five justices. So to the main case, I think it's important to give a little more historical perspective. So in the 1950s and 60s, there were major battles, cultural and legal and political, over the extent to which the government could channel public funds to the support of religious education. And that resulted in a settlement for a time that the answer was hardly at all. And then we saw in the rise of charter schools and school choice and so on that, no, it's not never. It's not that you can't do it. You don't have to do it, but you may do it. Through, as Michael said, the intervention of private choice. Parents make the choice of how to spend the money. So we've gone from you may not to you may, and now it's you must. And I'll just point out one more thing while I have the floor. The main program looked at schools not because they had a religious origin or even a religious name. I mean, there were many private schools throughout New England that were founded on religious grounds or have, you know, St. Paul have religious names attached to them. What the state looked at was, what the state's position was, that's fine, but we're not going to fund schools where religious doctrine is the heart of the curriculum. We're not going to fund religious education, qua education. And a few years ago, I'm here to say, Maine would have prevailed in that case.
So in that case, Justice Stephen Breyer, in one of his final dissents on his time on the court, wrote the following. He said, the First Amendment begins by forbidding the government from, quote, making any law respecting an establishment of religion. It next forbids them to make any law prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The court today pays almost no attention to the words in the first clause while giving almost exclusive attention to the words in the second. Michael, what is your response to Justice Breyer?
Kimberly, I just think that that is a misstatement of what the court has been doing. The Establishment Clause prohibits the government from using its power to favor religion. So if, for example, the state of Maine only gave money to private religious schools, that would be an establishment of religion. But the Establishment Clause does not require the government to be non-neutral. The whole idea of disestablishment was for the government to take itself out of the business of making religious judgments. So in operating and in subsidizing private schools in Maine, the question should be, do these schools meet the objective, neutral requirements of accreditation? And if they do, it is the government should be indifferent as to whether the schools also teach some other kind of ideology, whether it's a religious ideology. Some schools are quite political. Other schools have other commitments. It doesn't matter and shouldn't matter to the state what else the parents choose for their education. All that should matter to the state is educational quality.
So what is this idea, the separation of church and state that the founders tried to create with the First Amendment, supposed to accomplish, Linda? Is it supposed to accomplish, as Michael said, making the government neutral when it comes to religions, or is it supposed to accomplish something else?
No, I don't disagree with him on the neutrality point as a, you know, as an abstract principle. I think that's obviously correct. But in the kind of contentious playing field where these issues actually play out in real time, we see something other than that. You know, we see various workarounds that looked at from one point of view, you can say, okay, all we need is neutrality. But Maine took the position that all it was obliged to do under its, I believe it was a state constitutional provision, to support tuition for students from tiny school districts that couldn't afford to have their own high school, was to replicate the state tuition, to replicate the state curriculum. And if a school did that, fine. It didn't matter whether it was religious or political, as Michael says, or whatever. And the state deemed that a school with a curriculum infused with religious doctrine was not comparable to the, did not fit the definition that the state deemed necessary to qualify for the program. A school could certainly teach religion all it wanted. It just thereby wouldn't qualify for the state subsidy.
And Michael, is the government really obliged to try to keep a secular point of view? I mean, is it something beyond just not interfering and picking and choosing religions, but protecting even against those people who don't want taxpayer money to go to religion at all?
No, absolutely not. The government should no more be favoring a secular point of view than it should a religious point of view. The whole point of the First Amendment is to get the government out of the business of making judgments, whether for secularism, for religion, for one religion over another. When Maine decided, and it's actually a statute, but when Maine decided that it would accomplish its educational purposes by funding, it specifically said private schools are eligible. It did not.
Well, I'm going to hold you right there, Michael. We're going to come back on the other side of the break and talk about this more. We're talking about the Supreme Court and how it's interpreting the Establishment Clause. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. When we look at the separation of church and state, it's sometimes framed as a question of protecting the free exercise of Christianity, by far the nation's largest religious group. But that's not how all non-Christian groups see it. Ismael Royer is director of the Islam and Religious Freedom Action Team at the Religious Freedom Institute. His group has aligned itself with conservative Christian groups in many cases. He filed a brief to the Supreme Court in favor of Coach Joe Kennedy's right to pray on the football field.
I think that it's a gross slander and inner slur, really, to label this, you know, legal initiative to restore a more original understanding of the Establishment and First Free Exercise Clauses as somehow merely, you know, advancing some sort of radical Christian agenda. If you look at the actual reasoning of the court in their opinions, and you look at the reasoning of the advocates, they're citing cases and they're arguing from principles that go back to the time of the founding.
Ismael thinks those who advocate for strict secularism are missing the point and are ignorant about the roots of these doctrines.
It's true that there was a period, a long period, of quite secular interpretations of the Free Exercise Clause. And some of these opinions, by the way, were upholding laws that actually had been implemented and driven in state legislatures by anti-Catholic sentiment. And some of these laws that the Ku Klux Klan even supported, you know, with these, for example, the Blaine Amendments, for example, religious garb statutes in public schools, which the Kennedy versus Bremerton case explicitly renders those garb statutes now unconstitutional.
Those garb statutes mean state employees cannot wear clothing that their religion obliges them to wear. Ismael says it's laws like that, rather than Christian prayer on a football field, which are the greater threat to Muslims' religious freedom in the U.S.
The court's majority opinion said if we were to adopt the Ninth Circuit's opinion in this case, then that would mean that a Muslim woman wearing hijab, a religious head covering, would not could be fired for doing so. They explicitly intended that their opinion would apply to people of all faiths, and not just prayer, but also religious expression in general.
Even though the movement is being driven by the religious right, Ismael thinks it's of benefit to every faith group in America.
This is good for religious minorities. Religious minorities have much more to fear from a court that would drive the religious expression out of the public square than from a court which approves of religious expression by everyone in the public square.
I'm here with Linda Greenhouse, professor at Yale Law School and columnist for the New York Times. She covered the Supreme Court for the Times for 30 years and won a Pulitzer in 1998 for her work. I'm also joined by Professor Michael McConnell. He's the director of the Center for Constitutional Law at Stanford, and he previously served as a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 10th District, a nominee of President George W. Bush. And before I turn back to you, I want to bring in Michelle Borstein, religious reporter at The Washington Post. So, Michelle, we heard Ismael Royer just now making the case that these rulings are protective of all religions, including religious minorities. Is that your view? Is that the view, that, as you've reported, of the faith groups who are bringing these challenges?
Well, I think that we've been kind of talking about a lot of this in, you know, the binary, like there's before and after and religious and not religious. But I feel like we have to remember that, you know, these changes over the centuries happened, that there has been continual changes and discussions that were in response to specific things in history, like Ismael just mentioned, or I think whether it was Ismael or you just mentioned the Blaine Amendments, the application of establishment, the Establishment Clause to the states, was fueled in good part because the Protestant majority was concerned about Catholic schools, and then you had concern about communism in the, you know, early mid 1900s that led to like more civil religion, like putting under God into the pledge and on money and stuff like that. So, I mean, these are things that are, you know, and then also when it comes to, as you asked about religious groups, you have, I mean, what does religious mean today in the United States? It's very complicated, right? You have people who are very religious and unaffiliated. You have people who are, you know, their religion is very tied to specific denominations. You have people who are extremely spiritual and, you know, more secular in their politics. So, I mean, you have, it's not really religion versus non-religion. And you also have, as Ismael mentioned, this issue about funding for charter schools, which is in many cases religious and particularly conservative religions, but also plenty of secular groups. So it's kind of, it's more of a patchwork than it is really two sides. And I think, yeah, you know, you have, and I think the ideal that he's talking about, and I had a story about this a couple days ago where there was a interfaith leader who talked about this could be ideal for religious groups. And I think the concern on the other side isn't the ideal, but a lot of the reality in terms of the cases the Supreme Court takes and the plaintiffs it rules in favor of, and the rising Christian nationalism and, you know, Republican state parties taking positions explicitly in favor of, you know, Christian prayers said in school and that kind of thing. So it's also the context.
Right. So I want to read a little bit with respect to that context from a piece that you wrote a couple days ago in The Washington Post. You write, at a time when America is becoming more religiously diverse, unaffiliated, and secular, major rulings have rewritten decades of precedent and given victory after victory to religious practitioners seeking more voice, money, and access in the public square. Many have been conservative Christians who argued they'd been unconstitutionally shut out, with the door open much wider. The question many experts are asking now is, has the court ushered in a period of more pluralism for people of all religious faiths and none, or instead codified government power and privilege for those in the majority. Michelle, to people who say they believe that this is the court being influenced by Christian conservatives specifically, what do you say?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence for that. I mean, the story quoted a pretty comprehensive survey of cases that have been taken up by the Supreme Court since John Roberts has been there that are, you know, almost exclusively ruling in favor of what he called, what the study called mainstream Christian, but most of them are conservative Christians. In general, ruling dramatically much more for religion, about 80% of the time, compared with 50% of the time for all the previous eras since the 1950s. So I think there's, you know, I think there's definite, you know, facts behind their concern. I think, you know, one of the things that if you look back at, you know, the law around religion and separation issues, for a while there was a lot of agreement that really this was about protecting religious minorities, that that's what we needed to have, like, you know, special attention paid for establishment and that kind of thing. And I think, you know, some of the people I've talked to have talked about sort of the American interest in the underdog. And I think it's hard to ignore that today a lot of the biggest groups feel that they're underdogs. And I mean, they are, if you look at data, I mean, the percentage of Americans who identify as Christian, and again, that includes a lot of diverse people, has dropped like, I think close to like 15% or 20% in the last, it went from 80% to 65% in the last 10 or 15 years. So I think, you know, I think there's these other forces at play, which is, you know, there's this ideal world of tolerance, and then there's the reality of where we're at.
Yeah. So, Michael, I want to ask you, Justice Samuel Alito has complained in a Federalist Society speech. He lamented attacks on what he saw on religious expression, with things such as the COVID era restrictions on church gatherings, for example, which he said singled out religion and really painted a picture of religious expression under attack. But if you look at what the court itself has done, it has generally sided in favor of groups, including a lot of Christian groups, when it came to challenging those COVID era restrictions, when it came to religious employers not wanting to provide contraception coverage, when it comes to it was a narrow case, but even the case of the Colorado baker who didn't want to bake a cake for a same-sex marriage. It seems to me that, coupled with these recent decisions, that the court is giving very strong protection to religious expression. So is it something that is under attack? Is it the underdog, to use Michelle's word?
Well, there's no contradiction between these two things, because in many segments of society, especially universities, you know, left-oriented state governments and so forth, religion is often viewed with a great deal of suspicion. One of the cases last year, an unpronounceable case which I'll try as Uzweg Bunam versus Brzezinski, involved a public university that continually harassed students who were calmly and peacefully leafleting on a religious, you know, sharing their religious views on campus. And the Supreme Court unanimously held that those students were able to sue the university for damages. Coach Kennedy was he was fired from his job for quietly by himself going to the middle of the field after a game and offering a prayer while his students, that is the team members, were off, you know, singing the fight song somewhere else. There is a great deal of attack on religiosity in some quarters, and it has been the historic purpose of the Supreme Court to defend the underdog. It so happens that the underdog in many parts of American society today are religious, not just Christian, but as Ismail said, many others as well. If you look at what the cases in the Supreme Court, there have been victories for any number of religious persuasions. Just earlier this year, I thought one of the most important cases of the term protected the right of a person facing capital punishment to have the spiritual advisor of the religion of his choice. The immediately preceding case involved a Buddhist prisoner under similar circumstances. A few years ago, it was a Muslim woman who was working for Abercrombie and Fitch and not allowed
Michael,
to wear
I don't
want to
interrupt you, but I want to ask specifically a question about these two cases that we're talking about out of Maine in Washington. I played sports in school. I think if my coach were doing something in that realm, I might feel pressured to participate in that. And that is what the school district, the state of Maine was saying, the state of Washington was saying, that why they believe that that might violate the Establishment Clause if it looks like an endorsement, a government endorsement of religion. What do you say to that, Michael?
Michelle, could I weigh in here?
You have to look very.
One moment, Linda. I want to get Michael's reaction.
I was just
going to
say you have to be very careful about the facts of the case. And there had been a number of religious exercises in the past, and the coach agreed not to do them. All of that was over. In the end, he was fired not for any of that. He was fired. When his team was away, they weren't even observing. They were off doing their what the court calls pre-game, post-game traditions. There were three instances. In one instance, he was joined by the other team. In one instance, he was all by himself. And in the third instance, he was joined by some adults. But in no instance were his team members even involved in the exercises for which he was fired.
Okay, I want to give Linda a chance to respond.
Kimberly, I'm just going to push back on that account of the facts in the Coach Kennedy case, and I would urge listeners to go online and find the Ninth Circuit opinion, which is a recitation of the actual facts. The coach had constructed a circus atmosphere on the playing field. Members of the community would rush down from those stands. Even state legislators would come. He became a media figure. And the school district said to him, look, we're not trying to stop you from praying. We'll give you any other place on our campus that you can pray, but we don't want you on the 50-yard line creating this kind of circus. And so, you know, what Michael is cherry-picking, excuse me, and what the court cherry-picked in really defiance of the factual context, and Michelle is exactly right, context really matters. The last few instances after he was really under the gun, he sort of changed his tune. But,
he also wasn't fired.
He
didn't. He didn't apply for the next season.
Yeah. He was a part-time, JV coach. Who was making something like, $2,000 a year. And he basically was allowed, the Supreme Court has allowed him to commandeer a public high school football field for his religious display. And I'm here to say, 5 or 10 years ago, in no way would this guy have prevailed in the Supreme Court.
Well, Michelle, I want to turn back to you, giving your reporting on this. What do you think lies ahead for these battles between church and state? Do you think that the Establishment Clause is being weakened here?
Well, I think that the Establishment Clause has definitely been kind of dialed back. I mean, obviously, people like Michael would say it's a corrective, that it's been applied, and that a lot of people kind of grew up with this idea that there's no religion allowed in these public spaces. I think one of the things I've learned having covered being a reporter for a long time is just not to predict anything. I mean, I think this idea of looking back to history, which the justices have repeatedly stated in different cases that, it's about our history. you know, right now, obviously, America is fighting about what its history is and the meaning of its history for the present. And the religiosity of America today is very, very different from what it was like, you know, in the days of the founders. So I think anything is possible. I think it really depends on a lot of things, including, I mean, if you look at Bremerton, for example, that's just one community. But I mean, I think if you look at the relationships in a community and how people negotiate these differences, they can play out differently. Another thing is you've got a big infrastructure of, especially on the right, it exists on the left as well, but especially on the right of groups, have very well-funded groups that exist to pursue these cases. So, you know, what happens, I think, depends a lot on both the low, you know, kind of the business of religious freedom fighting.
Yeah. Michelle Borstein is from The Washington Post. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I will be right back with Linda Greenhouse and Michael McDonald. Please stay with us as we look ahead to the future of the church and state divide. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Storr. A word now about a show we're working on for later this week. Joe Biden called himself a, quote, transition candidate on the campaign trail in 2020. But what did he mean? Transition to who or what? Is the next era of the party and country ready to accept the baton? We want to hear your thoughts about whether or not President Biden should run again and who should lead in the Democratic Party. What do you see the country transitioning to? Tell us your thoughts at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. Today, we're looking at the separation of church and state and how the Supreme Court is changing that divide. Joining me is Linda Greenhouse. She covered the Supreme Court for the New York Times for 3 decades and is now Knight Distinguished Journalist in Residence and Joseph M. Goldstein Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School. Also, we're joined by Michael McConnell. He is the Richard and Francis Mallory Professor at Stanford Law School and Director of the Stanford Constitutional Center. So, Michael, I want to get your reaction. We've gotten a lot of responses from our listeners on Twitter, and I want you to respond to a couple. One is calling the recent Supreme Court decisions, quote, an attack. The court and its religious funders want to turn America into a Christo-fascist theocracy. Another person says, why should a single tax dollar of mine go towards supporting any religious or non-religious private education facility? My tax dollars should go to public education with no religious doctrine. Michael, what do you say to our listeners?
Well, as to the name calling, I don't have anything to say to that writer, that speaker. As to the second question, it's a very good question. No money should go from tax dollars for the purpose of supporting religion. Money should go from tax dollars, from your tax dollars, to support education. The question should be, are these schools educating young Americans in the various things that they need to be able to know? And we should not care whether, in addition to that, the school presents a point of view. The The problem here is that schools that are perfectly adequate schools, millions of Americans have over the century, since the beginning of the Republic, have gotten their schooling in religious schools. There is nothing wrong with religious schools. They provide education just like any other, and there's no reason they should be denied the funding that comes to them from that. Just as religious hospitals receive money, religious orphanages receive money, we do not in this country deny private organizations an equal chance to participate and provide public benefits just because they're religious.
So, Linda, what do you think will happen next? And will this be limited to challenges based on the free exercise clause? For example, next term, the court will hear an appeal from a Colorado web designer who does not want to perform services for same-sex couples to create their websites. Usually cases like this and the Masterpiece Cake Shop are brought under a free expression challenge. Do you see the same sort of tension between the free expression provision in the First Amendment and the freedom to express one's religion?
Yeah, so let's talk about the case that's going to be argued this fall. It's called 303 Creative. And the owner of 303 Creative is a web designer. She wants to get into the business of designing wedding websites, which are very popular these days. She claims that as a Christian, she can't possibly design a wedding website for a same-sex marriage. She lives in Colorado, just like the baker who wouldn't bake a few years ago. And Colorado has a robust anti-discrimination law that includes a ban against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So she went to court for claiming that she had both a free speech and a free exercise right to put on her website the fact that she would not serve same-sex couples who wanted to have a wedding website. And of course, she lost in the lower courts. So the Supreme Court, in agreeing to hear her appeal, actually a very strange act by the court because she's actually not yet in the business and she doesn't have a customer, unlike the baker who actually turned away people. There's no injury that's occurred yet. But anyway, the court granted the case nonetheless and agreed to decide only the free speech claim, not the freedom of religion, of religious exercise claim. I find that very puzzling because the speech she wants the freedom to engage in is based on her religious view of what she can and cannot do in her business and who she will and will not serve. So I'm not sure why the court thought it could get away with carving out the religious claim when that lies at the heart of the case. And I'll just say one more thing, which is that ever since Obergefell, the same-sex marriage decision in 2015, Justice Alito, who wrote a very vigorous free exercise infused dissent from Obergefell, has been looking for what you might say is an Obergefell victim. He wants a case that will crystallize his view that the existence of a constitutionally recognized right to same-sex marriage is an affront to religious people who believe that the Bible says marriage can only be between a man and a woman. But he needs to get that case. He needs a victim. And he has had trouble finding one. And now he's got one, Ms. 303 Creative. And the notion that this case is going to come down as a speech case and not a religion case, I find very hard to believe.
Well, Michael, I want to, on that point, read a bit of Alito's dissent in Obergefell and then come to you for your response. Alito wrote, "I assume that those who cling to old beliefs, meaning that the belief that marriage is between a man and a woman, will be able to whisper their thoughts in the recesses of their homes. But if they repeat those views in public, they will risk being labeled as bigots and treated as such by governments, employers, and schools. By imposing its own views on the entire country, the majority facilitates the marginalization of the many Americans who have traditional ideas." What do you say to what Linda said and what Alito wrote?
Well, apparently it's coming true. I don't think very often, but there certainly are cases where people who do not believe in same-sex marriage are being forced to speak, use their talents, use their efforts in support of something that they don't believe in. It's not at all puzzling that this is a free speech case. It's a compelled speech case. There are dozens of cases in the Supreme Court decided under freedom of speech principles that actually involve religious speech. Just look at all of the Jehovah's Witness cases in the Supreme Court. By limiting this case to the free speech claim, the court is making a narrower case having to do only with people who are engaged in expressive professions, things like web designers and wedding singers and composers and people of that sort. But wedding cake makers can be expressive as well. And essentially, the claim is that people who are engaged in expressive activities are permitted to decide whether they're going to use their talents in support of things that they strongly disapprove of. This is a freedom agenda. Many of us supported movements toward same-sex marriage on the assumption that this would enable people to live out their lives in accordance with their own conscience. Well, that goes for the people getting married, and it also goes for the people who don't want to support or participate in that. Why not just allow same-sex marriage without forcing people who don't believe in it to use their words in support of it?
Well,
Linda, go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, substitute interracial marriage for same-sex marriage, right? I mean, there's a long biblical tradition that says that people of different races shouldn't marry. And can we imagine a situation in the United States in 2022 where a web designer or a baker would say, you know, my religion just prevents me from serving interracial couples and, you know, go take your business elsewhere? I don't think so. And there's got to be some principled difference here, and I don't see the principled difference.
Well, it's not going to happen today because there aren't such people. But no one, you know, after Brown versus Board of Education, no one was going around telling churches that they had to conform to Brown. They weren't going around telling people that they had to speak out in support of desegregation. The principle of Brown was equality under the law. The government may not segregate, it may not discriminate, but there was no effort to force people who disagreed with Brown to shut up or to force to support the decision.
Let me ask you
That's
this.
What's
let me,
going
let me
on.
Bring
now
it.
It's an entirely different matter.
Let me bring it back to now. What about in other aspects? For example, there are some religious organizations, Jewish organizations, that are challenging abortion bans based on the fact that, according to their faith, life begins at birth. Under these same principles, do they have a valid challenge here?
I would like to see the details of the religious claim in that case. But in general, no, a person does not have a free exercise right to have the government's law based upon their own religious view of the matter. Now, if there were situations in which people of some faith had a religious obligation to get an abortion and they were being prevented from doing so, they might very well have a free exercise claim.
Linda, I want to ask you the same question, especially given the fact that this court, for example, ruled in favor by and large of churches who sought exemptions from COVID restrictions that they said infringed upon their religious practice rights.
Well, you know, I think it's entirely possible to look at the Dobbs opinion, the opinion that overturned Roe against Wade, as a religion case. You know, the opposition to abortion is based on a view of unborn life that is founded in religion. And this lawsuit in Florida is actually quite interesting. And I think we ought to expand our frame and label the Dobbs opinion for what it is. It's a religion case. just like the more overtly religious cases, the companies that wouldn't adhere to the Affordable Care Act contraception mandate and got away with it, you know, depriving their secular workforce of a statutory benefit that all other women in the country can enjoy. So, you know, we've come to a pass where these religious claims are infusing the court's view of what ought to be government law that applies to everybody. Yeah.
Michael, I want to ask you, there's been some concern that after the opinions in Hobby Lobby and others by the court, that we might see other employers making religious objections to covering things like anti-HIV drugs or other things as well. Is that possible here? Do you think that this broadens the ability of employers who have not necessarily religious organizations, but employers who express a religious objection to, as Linda said, have greater control over the decisions of their secular employees?
I think it would be a very good idea for people to stop scaremongering about this. I haven't heard of anyone raising such a claim. It makes no sense from a religious point of view. It's the Hobby Lobby claim was that four out of, I don't remember how many approved contraceptives are actually abortifacients. That is, that they actually kill. It is a perfectly understandable religious view that you don't participate in killing. The claims about HIV, there's nothing evil. There's no killing involved with an HIV drug. It's simply a way of healing people. The idea that we just shouldn't be running around scaring people that free exercise is going to result in all sorts of oppressive nonsense. It never has happened. The claims have been perfectly logical. They've been perfectly moderate. The Supreme Court is not some sort of extremist organization. Many of these free exercise cases, including Little Sisters of the Poor, including Fulton, the case last term about adoption services, have been either unanimous or nearly unanimous. Now, Hobby Lobby was not, but many of them have been. The idea that that this country is facing some sort of impending crisis, I just think is adding to our national inability to get along with one another. I think the Supreme Court's been doing a very good job in the area of religious freedom. It's been protecting everyone's rights. It has not been singling out Christianity for its protections. And I think all these claims are actually, undermining one of the great institutions of American of our American system. And
well, Linda, I want to give you one last chance.
Not imagine things.
Linda, just a few seconds we have left. I want to give you a chance to respond to that. Do you think that it's the culture wars that are driving this narrative and not the court itself?
I think what's driving the narrative is an empowered religious lobby with a lot of money and a lot of smarts picking those cases and those sympathetic plaintiffs who will come up to the court and persuade sometimes a strong majority of justices to rule their way. And we're all going to be living with those consequences.
Linda Greenhouse, Knight Distinguished Journalist in Residence and Joseph M. Goldstein Lecturer in Law at Yale Law School. Thank you for joining us. And Michael McConnell, Richard and Francis Mallory Professor at Stanford Law School and Director of the Stanford Constitutional Law Center. Thanks to you as well. I'm Kimberly Atkins-Store. This is On Point.